Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Tux Lerzel.
And Stephanie Domingo.
Yaha.
Yaha.
We come to you from Bushwick, Brooklyn, where we record on land belonging to the Lenape Nation, a nation that is one of many still very much out here doing its thing, and we'd like to acknowledge that.
Facts.
This is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government.
Sure enough.
We be drinking and we be swearing. So today, we are drinking a frosty, frozen version of a classic margarita, Mexico's classic tequila sour, which is one of the best known cocktails in the world at this point.
I agree strongly with that statement.
Like most classic cocktails, the origin story of this one is a little bit tough to nail down.
Yes.
As per usual.
I mean, that's kind of what happens.
Yeah.
It's old, right? I mean, I guess
it's not as old as you might think. Yeah. It's from
the 70s, I guess.
Well, it was frozen margaritas specifically were huge in the 70s. Mm-hmm. It's a couple decades earlier than that it got big, but like
still recent.
Yeah. Very recent.
They should
know. Yeah.
Or just like people be lying sort of thing.
People are drunk.
Oh,
I think and a lot of it is like, oh, you know, this like guy fixed you a cocktail sort of like custom for you. You liked it, so you had somebody else make it and then had somebody else make it. And it kind of is like, it's like a game of telephone with alcohol.
Yeah, the recipes sort of are tweaked. And
yeah,
like, okay,
exactly.
This is the one that's the best one.
Totally.
We're calling it the margarita.
Yeah. So to start with, I have to say, this is Beyond Reproach's first ever tequila cocktail.
This feels exciting.
Woo-woo!
This feels inaugural.
Yes, yeah. Bust out the Jamaican air horns, Mexican air horns.
No, they don't have air horns.
I know. So I want to talk really briefly about the history of the consumption of tequila in the United States before we get into the cocktail. I'm going to keep it brief, though, I promise.
Okay.
So before Prohibition, tequila was basically unknown in the United States. Save for like a few like border towns with large Mexican populations, nobody knew even what the fuck tequila was, let alone did they drink it. But when Prohibition hit, a lot of Americans started driving south of the border to get their booze.
They're just like, what you got?
Yeah,
what
exactly.
You got down there?
So they're driving at these like border towns like Tijuana and other areas. Most people were going to these bars and being like, I'll have my old standby from like, I'm going to have some fucking like American whiskey and English gin and Cuban rum. Mm. I don't know what the fuck that shit is with the worm in it or whatever, but I don't want anything to do with that. But there were a few sort of adventurous souls that were like, okay,
like,
I'll try
squirrel,
it.
Please. Get the fuck out of here.
And the thing was, like, tequila back in the day wasn't traditionally in Mexican culture, wasn't used to make a mixed drink. You wouldn't make, there was like a sort of punch that you would make with tequila sometimes for like a special occasion.
Yeah.
And they sometimes added like
They're
sugar
having
and
it
bitters.
Straight, normally.
Yeah, usually you would drink it straight. But a lot of spirits
are kind of that way, right?
Yeah. But so, like, Americans just didn't know what to do with it because they're not going to drink it straight or with, like, with salt and lime. They're like, what?
No, they don't get that.
Yeah. But there were, like, these handful of people that were like, I'll try it. I'll see what this is about. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to mix stuff with it because I'm American.
Yeah. I'm not there yet.
Yeah.
Maybe one day I can have it straight with some lime and salt.
Yeah. But they're like, I'm here. Let me try your, like, what you got. Give me what you got. So after Prohibition was repealed in the 30s, in 1933, some Americans kept wanting to drink tequila. They developed a taste for it, and they were into it, and they were like, okay, now that I can drink here in my own home again, give me that fucking tequila.
It's called a hankering.
Yes, hankering, yes. It's not a hankering.
You're right.
It's a hankering.
It's a hankering.
Yeah. This was especially popular in L.A. for, like, Americans to be like, ooh, give me that tequila.
Yeah.
Menus from several Mexican restaurants in the late 1930s started featuring a surprising number of tequila-based mixed drinks. because Americans were like, no, mix it with something for me, please.
Make it sweet.
Yeah.
Make it good.
Yeah. However, none of these restaurant menus featured what we know today as a margarita. It just wasn't a thing yet.
So what were they doing? Do you know? Like early?
Okay. I'm not really sure. Yeah. I'm sure it was some sort of like citrus juice and sweetener.
That's what I would assume.
Yeah. I'm sure it wasn't too far off.
Probably like orange or lime or something like that.
Yeah, totally. But when you want to trace back the roots of the margarita specifically, if you look, there's countless stories about the origins of the margarita, who invented the margarita. There's way too many to even be able to recount all of them. So many. And most of them, well, pretty much they all sort of say like it happened either in the 30s or the 40s, which kind of tracks. Like it makes sense that it would have happened when they say it did.
Yeah.
But they're all saying all of these stories, pretty much every single one is like, oh, we named it after the sort of like unknown anecdotal woman named Margaret or Marjorie or Maggie. Margarita, you know, we're gonna like put a Spanish twist on Maggie and call it a margarita. Every one of these stories.
That's a lie.
Yeah, totally. That's totally.
Because there are just people named Margarita.
One of these stories actually says that the margarita was named after actress Rita Hayworth because her real name, Rita is short for her real name, which is Margarita.
Of course. Yeah. That is an old name.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That also wasn't exactly true. They're saying like she was on set in Tijuana and blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
It's not true.
But at least that's her name, and because that's a name.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it is a name. A name. Yeah, totally. So all of these stories have sort of like a plausible element to them, but none of them have like real proof.
Mm-hmm.
So enter cocktail historian David Wunderich,
my
like idol.
Yeah. I just think that one day we're going to be the best of friends.
I mean, and like, he lives maybe in Brooklyn, I think.
Delusion, so he does.
Either Brooklyn or Manhattan.
Yeah, he lives in Brooklyn. And I'm not stalking him. He lives in Brooklyn, and one day we're going to be the best of friends.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He's going to be like, you got it all wrong.
And then we're going to become mortal enemies.
Yeah.
He doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about.
Fuck you, David. Well, he says basically of these stories that they have the time frame right, the 30s and 40s, would have been when the margarita was actually invented. But rather than being named after some unknown Margaret, margarita was actually named after a much older classic cocktail from the 1860s or 70s called a Daisy. So the original Daisy was made with whiskey. But as I've mentioned multiple times on the show, back in the day, cocktail recipes were sort of looked at as like a guideline more than like you have to make it this way.
Yeah, you could switch spirits.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was all about like the ratios.
100%. Yeah. So you could make a Daisy with anything. It didn't have to be whiskey. But no matter what base spirit you used, it was always made with lemon juice and orange liqueur and usually mixed with a little soda water.
Oh, soda water. Cool.
Yeah. According to Wunderich, at some point in the mid-1920s...
They had soda water in the
1800s. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think we did I think it was a gin punch we did one time, and it was from, like, the 1880s or 90s, I want to say. And I was like, wait, we had soda water back then?
Wow, they had soda streams.
Yeah. But so according to Wunderich, at some point in the mid-1920s, a customer walked up to Henry Madden, a bartender at the Turf Bar in Tijuana, and asked Madden for a gin Daisy. He told a reporter in 1936, I grabbed the wrong bottle, the tequila bottle. Quote, the customer was so delighted that he called for another and spread the good news far and wide. By the mid-1930s, the tequila Daisy was all over Mexico. Everyone loved tequila Daisy.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's tequila, lemon juice, orange liqueur, and sometimes a little bit of soda with ice. Okay,
that sounds delightful.
Yeah, it spread all over Mexico, started spreading to Los Angeles, and some people even started adding a salt rim to the glass because the Daisy is a close cousin to the sidecar, which comes with a sugared rim. But at the time, everyone knew that you drank tequila with salt. Mm-hmm. So they were like, let me put salt instead of sugar.
Yeah.
So by now, maybe you're probably asking yourself, like, what the fuck does Daisy have to do with margarita, though? What about this name? Turns out, if you translate the word Daisy, like the Daisy flower in Spanish, Margarita.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It means Daisy.
It means Daisy.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So that's where the name comes from. It is literally Spanish for Daisy. So the first time the margarita recipe appeared in print was in 1953 in the pages of Esquire magazine. She's from Mexico, señores, and her name is the margarita cocktail.
No.
She is lovely to look at, nope. Exciting, and provocative.
I disagree with all of this. You don't have to sexualize a cocktail, men.
I mean, she is pretty exciting and provocative.
I roll.
So the recipe that followed in this article in 1953 was exactly what we would recognize as a standard margarita today. Tequila, lime juice, triple sec, and a salted rim. A few years later, things really took off in around probably 1955-ish, when a Los Angeles liquor distributor noticed that one of his accounts was selling more tequila than anyone else. And it was because they had a margarita on their cocktail menu.
Ooh.
So he went in and was like, this is why you're selling so much tequila.
This is delicious.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he starts telling all of his other accounts, like, hey, if you make a margarita at the bar, you're going to sell a fuck ton of tequila.
Okay. So he spread it around.
Yeah. And by the early 60s, every Mexican restaurant in America knew how to make a margarita. Everyone. And by the 70s, practically every single bar, not just Mexican restaurants, but every bar in America was making margaritas by the 70s. Rewind a little bit back into the 60s. So in the 60s, while this is happening, while they're spreading from Mexican restaurants to every bar.
Just bars.
Blenders and frozen drinks are also becoming really popular in the 60s. So the frozen margarita becomes a very common and very popular variation on a margarita. And then in 1971, a Dallas restaurateur named Mariano Martinez got really fucking sick and tired of his bartenders getting backed up while they're trying to fill all these orders for frozen margaritas, but they're working with blenders trying to make one margarita at a time in a blender. He's like, this is bullshit. We got to figure it out a different way.
It is bullshit.
So he bought an old soft serve machine and adapted it to make the world's first frozen margarita machine.
Whoa.
Yeah. And it was an
incredible.
Instant hit.
Of course.
Just a few years later, Jimmy Buffett released his top 10 hit Margaritaville. No. Which is no surprise in 1977.
How dare you bring Jimmy into
this? And Martinez's original margarita machine that his prototype was entered in the Smithsonian in 2005.
Oh, cool.
It's in the Smithsonian.
I mean, it should be.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, it's such an iconic drink and it changed the way that people have frozen cocktails.
Totally. And the margarita basically like this one cocktail almost single-handedly introduced tequila to America.
Mm-hmm.
Like people in fucking Wisconsin are suddenly drinking tequila because of one cocktail. So let's take a little sip here. Cheers.
Cheers. A little cheersy cheers. The glasses are a little thick, so.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
Oh, that is delightful.
Who doesn't love a frozen margarita? I wish it was summer and we were outside.
Exceptional.
So while a frozen margarita has basically the same ingredients as a regular one, tequila, lime juice, and triple sec, usually you use Cointreau.
Cointreau, yeah.
The one difference is that a frozen margarita needs more sugar, usually in the form of simple syrup or agave.
It's because of the ice or something?
It's because of the ice. Because you're like that super cold, slushy ice numbs your senses on your tongue.
Yeah.
Your tongue can't sense the sweetness.
Or the alcohol.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't taste boozy at all.
The snow clone one.
Oh,
julep.
The julep. Yeah, the prescription julep. Yeah, you don't taste alcohol at all.
It was all alcohol and a little bit of sugar, and it tasted like sugar.
Yeah, totally. But so the one difference between the recipe for a regular margarita and a frozen is you add simple syrup, because without the addition of extra sugar, it wouldn't taste right. It just tastes like it's too tart. Mm-hmm. It's kind of bitter. It doesn't really work the way it's supposed to. So to make a frozen marg, basically you take a regular one and add a little simple syrup. The only other note that I have is you have to use fresh lime juice. You can't
There's no way around it, right?
You can't go to the store and get that like green limeade. Shit. The,
yeah.
The stuff that's like frozen, you probably like, could use limeade because it's so sweet.
Yeah.
For a frozen in a pinch, could, you could. Yeah. But don't go thinking you can buy that green bottle.
Oh, yeah. The preservative stuff.
It's not going to taste right. It's going to taste...
A little lime bulb.
Bad. Yeah. That's it. That's the frozen marg.
It's so delicious.
Your story is from the 70s, right?
It is from the 70s.
Frozen marg is the way to go.
So I'm dipping my toe into some true crime today. I guess I've done true crime before. I did Rosemary Kennedy. In my mind, I'm like, oh, this is uplifting because it's like a rich woman. But it was criminal what they did to her.
Facts.
cutting out her brain. So the events in my scandal, they take place in San Francisco in the 1970s, the late 1970s.
Really?
My story, it intersects homophobia, diet culture, police brutality, cults, city planning, mental health, and real estate development.
All of the things.
All of the things. It's like a grab bag, but like the opposite of like goodies in it.
Baddies.
No, baddies is actually like a sexy thing.
Yeah, baddies are good.
And they fucking wish they were baddies. No one in this story is a baddie, okay?
Trashies.
Yes. Trashies. So this story... It intersects a lot of things. There's a lot of layers, a lot of moving parts. So I'm just jumping right in.
Go for it. Yes, please.
So my scandal this episode is the assassination of Harvey Milk in the subsequent Twinkie defense.
Oh, my God.
Right? Woo! So Harvey Milk, for those who don't know, was a very charismatic gay activist who was assassinated a year after his election to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Milk became a city official to bring about positive changes in his community. He said, I finally reached the point where I knew I had to become involved or shut up.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he would be permanently shut up by one of his ain't shit colleagues.
Trashy.
So let us raise our glasses.
Yes, please.
To one of the many examples of straight white men getting away with literal murders, plural, using defenses that would have been laughed out of court if used by anyone else.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cheers.
Oh my God, cheers. Oh, I hope Harvey would be happy to have a margarita with us.
I think he would be.
Yeah, he totally would have.
He was such a fun person and like such a multifaceted like human.
Yeah.
He loved the theater.
Most of the listeners probably have heard of him at least and maybe have seen the movie.
Yeah, so for that reason, I thought a lot of people already knew... at least a little bit about him.
Yeah.
So I don't really talk very deeply about his life.
Yeah, that's fair.
But yeah, I'm going to put some references in the show notes of things that you should watch if you've not watched already. But yeah, I'm just going to jump right in. Perfect. So San Francisco today is a city of contrasts. The gap between rich and poor widens fucking every day. It's a city that has outrageous rents.
Yeah.
Rents that make New York look affordable.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is upsetting. The property value sky high, and it's led to this huge unhoused population in a city that touts its like progressive chops.
Totally.
So it's a bit of a head scratcher, but most of the foundation for its current state was laid in the late 1970s mm-hmm. by some of the people in this scandal.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So San Francisco back then, like most cities, was majority white, mostly mm-hmm. like generations upon generations, Irish and Italian mostly. But there's always been indigenous, Mexican, Asian, black people in the mix as well.
Yeah.
By the mid 60s, young white hippies were starting to flood in.
Sure.
This is like, you know, flower power, like...
Hate Ashbury.
So a few years after they start flooding in, the LGBTQ... plus folks, they start rolling in really big numbers. Minorities of all kind during this time were pushing for change. This was the era of like Black Panthers. There's a lot of Native American activism happening in San Francisco at this time. also in the mix were a bunch of weird cults.
Really?
Yeah. Doing their weird cult thing. It was a time of a lot of just dynamic change. These changes inspired a lot of people, but it scared and kind of angered everyone else. The big gay community, like hippies, sure. Okay. The left,
yeah.
Black people, Native Americans. Yeah.
Yes, just please, like, give me all of that.
Yeah. But some people are just like, shh.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, sure. Yes.
So gay issues were starting to make their way into the mainstream. 1977 was the year that Harvey was elected to the Board of Supervisors, and it was 8 years post the Stonewall riots.
Yeah.
So more people were coming out, becoming more visible, gay people, lesbian people. This was also the era of Anita Bryant.
If what I wouldn't give to slap her in the face with a pie myself.
Yeah. So that's how I knew her, from the pie meme.
Yeah.
Just because I knew nothing about her, but I saw that pie meme, and there's just something about the way she carried herself that made me realize that this woman deserved this pie.
Oh, 100%.
Like, it just felt right, you know?
Yeah, you know, do you know more about her now?
I know more about her now.
Yeah, but is she a part of this story?
Kind of, sort of.
Yeah.
You can do a little overview.
She was like an orange juice heiress.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah. I didn't know that you knew that.
Yeah.
So she was the spokesman for Florida orange juice.
Yeah.
Did you know about all the there was activism around orange juice in the late 1970s?
Oh, I didn't know that.
The gay community was boycotting orange juice. So if you went to a gay bar and ordered a screwdriver, people were just like, fuck no.
Because of her? Or
Yeah. They were boycotting orange juice.
Okay. Yes. I did know that. Yeah. Because of her.
Because she was known for anti-gay ballot initiatives.
Yeah. She's awful.
She's the worst. She was a professional bigot.
I read something in the early 2000s or mid 2000s that she said, she said that she was sad she didn't have any gay friends. It's like, bitch.
Wait, what?
Do you know who you are? have you seen you?
So I had to Google. I'm like, this is a fucked up Google. I'm just like, is she dead?
Please, God.
She's still alive. She's 81. Oh, God.
Someone go fucking throw a pie in her 81-year-old face right now.
Totally. She deserves it. She was a conservative Christian. In my outline, I just say conservative Christian asshole.
Facts are facts, America.
So this is the general vibe leading up to Harvey becoming in office. There's also a little bit of diet culture happening at this time. This was the rise of Whole Foods and bran. Bran became very sexy. People are making their own yogurt. There's something called carob.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about carob?
Yes, I've had carob.
I've never had carob.
Yeah, it's sort of
like a chocolate,
but not chocolate. Fake chocolate, yeah.
Yeah.
It's for people that are allergic to chocolate. Or
bitter. It didn't look like chocolate.
Yeah.
So let's get into it. On November 3rd, 1977, Harvey Milk on his third attempt and Dan White on his first attempt both become elected to San Francisco's Board of Supervisors as Democrats. Mm. You know, bully for them. So San Francisco, for those who don't know, I didn't know, it is a city and a county.
Mm,
and for that reason, they don't have a city council. They have a board of supervisors.
Oh,
so if I slip up and say city council, just autocorrect for me.
Yeah.
So the board of supervisors, it was made up of 11 people who worked with the mayor to get city shit done.
Huh.
The following year, when all the new supervisors were starting their positions, George Moscone, who was the city's white but very progressive mayor at the time, he was kind of being celebrated in the press because this new board of supervisors was the most diverse board of supervisors they've ever had up until that point. He had been in office for 3 years and had been elected by a mostly black and queer constituent.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He was Italian-American, as you can tell from his name.
Yeah.
and he ran against another Italian-American. And it was very close. But the black and the gay community basically pushed him over the edge because he ran on a platform of reforming the police.
Oh, wow.
And cracking down on police brutality. and pushing for civil rights for both groups. So they're just like, yeah, you can have our vote. Like, if you're going to protect us.
I love that that was possible in the 70s, but it's a bridge too far in New York. Very, very, 2022.
Very radical for his time, even in San Francisco, 1977. This was like extremely radical.
Wow.
I took this out of my outline. There were disabled activists who had taken over this city building in San Francisco for like a whole month. And people are asking him like, oh, like, what are you going to do about all these people? They like took this building. He's like, yeah, it's okay.
Yeah.
Like, I support them.
Yeah.
They're pushing for their rights. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Nothing.
Him, mind your business.
Exactly. Next question.
Yeah.
So he was, he was very, very, very progressive for his time. And yeah, he was doing a lot of really good things. So his campaign for mayor, he had the backing of the People's Temple.
Oh, okay.
The Jonestown people.
Wow.
Jim Jones was a big supporter of his.
Yeah.
So,
enter the cults.
Yeah. So I'm not going to go too deep into Harvey Milk, like the man. There's been a lot of media about him. Tons of biographies have been written. There's a really great documentary. I'm going to put this all in the show notes. There's a movie that came out in 2008 starring Sean Penn, also known as Scene P.
How dare you? Oh, my God. Okay.
You're going to have to explain this.
I have several many years ago, I went on a big lake house vacation with my sister and her best friend and both of their kids and my mom, and a boatload of people all came. But my young nephews, who were not great.
He has twin nephews. Yes. They're adorable, but also they're young men now. And I need to throw myself into the East River.
Yeah, they were younger then, but also even for the for their age, they were not great at reading. Exactly. And we were playing
Cards Against
Humanity. We were playing Cards Against Humanity, and they pulled a card and apparently didn't know who Sean Penn was. And read the card as Seen Peen.
I love it. I love it so much. It tickles me. Every time I see his name now
Seen
in
Peen.
My head, I have to auto-correct away from Seen Peen.
I fell out.
Of course.
I was like...
You can't make this shit up. Like, that is remarkable. So I'm not going super deep into Harvey Milk's life, but for the purpose of this scandal, you should know that he grew up in a middle class Jewish household in Long Island. He was an army vet who was discharged on suspicion of being gay from the army. He was a Republican for most of his life. Not many people know that. He even campaigned for Barry Goldwater against LBJ's like Great Society.
I did not know this.
Yeah. He would eventually work on Wall Street, as you do as like a rich white man back then.
Yeah.
But his politics start to change in his late 30s.
Okay.
He starts hanging out with theater people, like counterculture people. He meets some gay activists. And by his early 40s, he comes out of the closet.
Yeah.
And he moves to San Francisco with a partner. And together they open up a camera store on Castor Street.
Yeah.
In the heart of the gayborhood. During his final successful campaign for the Board of Supervisors, this was his third try. Every try he got more and more to the left, which is great.
Oh, I love that that's what it took for him to get elected,
well,
to go further left.
He came in as a very conservative gay.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though he was out,
the
gay people there were just like, who the fuck are you? And like, you're not us.
Yeah, yeah.
So he had to move.
I mean, it's great that he got there.
Yeah.
I'll say that.
He was living a lie.
Yeah.
He was trying to be a straight white man.
And 2022.
But also in New York, he was trying to do this. But it was back then and it wasn't safe. And the police were really violent.
No, totally. That's like
then.
In 2022, the like self-loathing gaze is real. Like, there's so much internalized homophobia and hatred that's like still alive and well today.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't even imagine what it could have been like for somebody who was a fully grown adult man in
fully
the 70s.
Grown. Yeah. Like, I think he came out when he was 41 or 42. in his like late 40s, he was so himself. And it that, was just, I mean, such it's a great that he
finally
see.
Got to do that, because I'm sure being a 20-year-old man in the 50s in America, at the height of the Lavender Scare and, you know, conform or get the fuck out.
I mean, he was kicked out of the army.
Yeah, exactly.
Based on suspicion.
Yeah.
In his campaign, he was pushing for gay rights, obviously, but he was also, he also supported affordable child care, free public transportation, the development of a civilian review board for the police.
Incredible.
So weeks after he won his election, he was really afraid that he was going to be killed.
Sure.
He recorded a political will. He is quoted as saying, "If a bullet should enter my brain, let that bullet destroy every closet door." So Dan White, his colleague, he was also a white working class former vet like Harvey. But unlike Harvey, he was straight and conservative and a bigot.
Yes, very straight-laced.
He ran on a platform opposing what he called San Francisco's social deviance.
Jesus Christ.
Those are the words he said with his mouth, you guys. What? He was a former cop. That's how you know he was good. And at the time he won the Board of Supervisors position, he was a firefighter. And he had to step down from that position because you weren't allowed to draw like two city paychecks.
Oh, okay.
So he had to quit that job even though it paid more. And this is going to be an issue later.
Okay.
So in the weeks following their election to the board, these two men, they appeared together on like local talk shows. They were very, very like buddy-buddy, very chummy. They praised each other. Milk told his friends on multiple occasions like he was looking forward to working with Dan White. I think part of that is he himself used to be conservative.
Sure.
Maybe he thought that he could like bring him along, like, maybe move him left. He was very optimistic. In the beginning, these three men, meaning like Dan White, Harvey Milk, and George Moscone, the mayor, they work really, really well together. Harvey went to Dan's kid's baptism. They're becoming like friendly, not friends, but like, you know, they're doing that colleague thing.
Sure. Yeah.
So at his first, at their first board meeting in January, Milk proposed this comprehensive ban on discrimination against gay people in San Francisco. And everyone on the board is made up of 11 people. Everyone is kind of like, they receive this very well. Everyone's kind of like, yeah, let's talk more about this. Let's develop it.
Yeah.
This sounds really, really good, obviously. So in April is when things kind of hit the fan. This is when tensions start to rise between Dan and Harvey. They clashed over a mental health facility that was proposed for Dan White's neighborhood. Harvey supported it.
Yeah.
Dan is just like, fuck no.
Not in my neighborhood.
Not in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And just like that, they were enemies.
Wow.
And
that's all it takes.
Dan would vote against Harvey at every single opportunity he had. He stopped talking to Harvey directly. He would only talk through his aide.
Over like, that?
Petty. Yes.
Throw the fuck up.
So when the supervisors voted on this non-discrimination ordinance that Harvey had backed, an ordinance that said that you shouldn't be able to fire gay people just because they're gay or you suspect they're gay.
Yeah.
Dan White was the only opposing vote out of 11 people.
But was into it before.
Yeah.
Before this proposed mental health facility.
Yeah. For children.
For Are you children. Fucking
run by nuns.
Me?
He didn't want it in his neighborhood. Juvenile.
I cannot.
I know.
And then, like, suddenly, oh my God.
Yeah. So this is why I did this story, because I'm like, everyone knows about the Twinkie defense and, like, that it's bullshit. But, like, the details are, like, your head is going to explode. Your head is going to explode.
Like, I've seen the movie, but I don't remember that detail. Or I don't know if they didn't discuss it or
it
didn't dwell
on it. It is, like,
the
details of this case are so, so maddening. So in addition to Dan White and all of his pettiness, there was fighting with just all of the progressive colleagues over real estate development. He was a YIMBY type. Do you know what YIMBY is?
No, I have no idea.
Yes in My Backyard.
Oh.
It's like the contrary to NIMBY.
Sure.
He wanted more city development and more housing in San Francisco. Yeah, I mean... And I agree with Dan with a caveat.
Okay.
Because a lot of development is like luxury development, not like low income housing.
Sure.
And yes. In New York actually does it really well now. A lot of most of their new housing is a mix of incomes.
Pretty much any development has to have a portion of it that is low income.
Yeah. I am all yes in My Backyard if 60% of luxury housing goes to people who have low income.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think just rich people should have nice places to live. I think everyone should have a nice place to live.
I mean, people wouldn't be able to live in this city otherwise.
Yeah.
You know.
Like, exactly.
Which is exactly what's happening in San Francisco today.
Yup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's where we're going.
That's where we're going. Look at you. At this time, the Board of Supervisors basically made it illegal to build any new housing, even while the city was growing and adding new jobs. This is like, partly why like housing is so precious there now.
Do y'all not understand how cities work?
Like, nope.
They have to go up or out. You can't like, and San Francisco isn't quite as landlocked as Manhattan is, but it's still restricted geographically.
Harvey Milk and Mayor Moscone, they felt that they should take a more neighborhood approach to curb development. They wanted single-family homes. They didn't want multiple generations living in houses. They wanted the city to remain small and neighborhoody, which is kind of racist because most housing that has more than just one family is typically not white.
Yeah. To a certain extent, I sort of understand, like, in theory, that the character of the city, when you think of San Francisco, you're not thinking of skyscrapers. You're thinking of those, like, the painted ladies,
yes,
like going up the hill.
Yeah.
So I understand why they want to keep some.
They want to keep all.
Yeah, that's. It's a city. You can't do that. It's just not how cities work.
I know. Well, they thought otherwise.
Yeah.
And this is why we are in the predicament that we are in San Francisco.
That's literally, it's a city.
It's a city.
Yeah.
A big one.
It's got to go up or out.
Yeah. The debate became pretty contentious. Dan repeatedly got into like multiple shouting matches with his colleagues, like this was the UK, like screaming at people. The big thing that they were fighting about now, because city planning is very big.
Sure.
Real estate development is very big. But like the really, really big thing that Dan really supported was a proposal that would allow essentially anyone who owned real estate for 10 years to sell it without paying tax.
What? That's
outrageous.
Idiotic. Without tax?
Without any
tax. Zero tax.
Zero tax. Zero tax. So there's all this tension. So Dan, he feels like everyone hates him, his colleagues, like no one's listening to him because he's saying crazy shit and they're kind of laughing at him in a way.
Nobody respects you because you're not acting like an adult.
Yeah.
Honey.
So on November 10th, 1978, he decides that he's going to resign. Conflict resolution was not
an adult thing to do.
A strength of his. He is.
I quit.
He's an ex-cop. Conflict resolution isn't what he does. So the progressives and the mayor, everyone's fucking thrilled.
Like, okay, goodbye.
Because he is a fly in the ointment. Like, he's the one who, like, can't get along with anyone, is being super petty with not just Milk, other people. Like,
sure.
Like, the first black board of supervisor person.
Yes, thank
supervisor,
you.
Supervisor, thank you. The first black supervisor is... He's having beef with him. He's having beef with this
imagine
other, like,
that.
Jewish woman. Like, he's having beef with everyone who doesn't believe what he believes. And he's the only one who believes what he believes. So he decides he puts in his letter of resignation.
Girl, bye.
Yeah, right? So again, there's almost like a ticker tape parade. Everyone's
excited. Everyone's like, okay.
Like, oh, we can do city business.
Yeah, without all this drama and childishness and...
So the mayor is so thrilled that he's finally going to get to appoint someone who supports his vision on development, even though his vision on development is kind of trash. But whatever. He doesn't want fights, you know, amongst his people. But do you know who isn't thrilled? White people in power.
Oh, okay. I was like, Anita Bryant?
White people in power. Yeah, they hear okay. that Dan yeah. White has resigned and they lose their shit. He was their man on the inside. Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
The people most in their feelings over White's exit were the police union, business leaders, and the board of realtors. They yeah. were not trying to house the poor or yeah, middle exactly. income people exactly. at all. Yeah.
I'm sitting here. For the past like 20 minutes, like, why would Dan be all about this and the progressives were against it? I'm like, oh.
But also, okay. I do really think that progressives didn't foresee the future. For Harvey, he liked the cute little town he had.
Sure, absolutely.
Especially coming from New York, he's just like, oh, this is let's freeze it here.
Yeah, totally. And
is like, you can't do that when the city is growing.
Yeah.
Like, that is a hindrance. You are hurting the city to do totally. That. So the cops are pissed.
Sure.
Because they're afraid that they won't be able to be violent in their regular,
there's going
to
be a civilian review board.
Unchecked ways against their favorite communities to harass gay people and black people, the usual suspects.
Clutching their guns,
yes. Business people and realtors, they want to build big, fancy, multi-unit housing wherever they can.
Yeah.
And they're being constricted. So they basically told him, they told Dan, you got to unresign.
Oh, Jesus.
So he went back to Moscone and was like, hey, man, I was on some bullshit the other day.
Just kidding.
I didn't mean to rage quit, but can I have my job back? Moscone was very sympathetic. He's just like, oh, I'll think about it. I don't know. Let me have this cook for a bit.
Girl, you just had a fucking temper tantrum and stormed out.
Yeah.
No, you can't have your fucking job back.
Meanwhile, Harvey Milk basically threatens the mayor. He's like, if you do this, if you let him rescind his fucking resignation, you are done in the gay community. Yeah. We're not going to support you next time. You're not going to win without us. So
yeah.
I mean, he said that you won't be able to be elected dog catcher. Harvey Milk was doing all that all the time.
It feels very white. You don't need to.
He was calling the manager, basically.
Yeah. But, literally called the manager.
So
I'm not going to shop here anymore.
Exactly. At the Limited. Get the fuck out of here. So yeah, he said, if you reappoint this dude, you're done in the gay community. Yeah. So it gets kind of heated at one point during this waiting period because Dan White has hired counsel.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Dude, threw a temper tantrum.
Yes.
You're the one that said you didn't want to do this anymore.
He files a court order to keep Mayor Moscone from appointing a new replacement. And the court is like, ain't nobody told you to rage quit?
Literally a court order to stop you from doing what you said you wanted to do.
I'm just moving my hands. You can't hear my hands flail.
Good but God, yeah, girl, get a grip.
A good time for a little break. See
the 5 G's.
The 5 G's.
Good God, girl, get a grip.
Oh, yes! I love that. Oh, amazing.
Welcome to Hashtag History. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah. And if you're a history nerd
or even a history hater,
this is the podcast for you.
Even if history was your least favorite subject in school, we can guarantee you will like this podcast because we talk about all the things that your history textbooks did not.
Things like how the Bonnie Prince Charles and his Jacobite uprising was a bit of a disaster.
Yeah, or how the pharaoh Akhenaten was so disliked by Egyptians that they literally purged his name from nearly all of their records and pretended like he had never existed.
And we do all of this while drinking and rating a custom-made cocktail specific to that week's topic.
So grab a drink, take a seat, and hang out with us each week as we learn all about history's greatest stories of controversy,
conspiracy,
and corruption.
Whew. All right, we're back. Oof. I just had a little brain freeze action.
It's worth it.
Occupational hazard.
Yes.
I need to call OSHA.
By your own hand, too. So I just talked about how Dan White rage quit and now he's mad. You did this.
Unbelievable.
It's not just I quit. Like, here is my letter of resignation.
I'm seeking counsel to force you to keep me after that, I handed in.
So about that paper I gave you, can I have it back to rip up? can I have that back to rip up, please?
I was never here.
So 8 days after Dan White resigned, just oddly enough, Jonestown happened.
8 days.
8 days. Oof. Which is why I brought it up in the beginning, because I'm like, there's a lot of shit happening this scandal.
Yes.
And this is a huge deal because Moscone, he had a ton of volunteers who were affiliated with the People's Temple. And there were a lot of supervisors who just knew people. So there were a ton of people who were personally affected by this tragedy.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Security was increased at City Hall just because they're like, I don't know what's going to happen. All these people just died. I don't know if there's going to be any sort of other violence or cult-related things happening. Sure,
yeah.
So they just wanted to make sure that everyone was safe. After the dust settles, a couple days after Jonestown, Moscone decides that he's going to appoint someone who was on Milk's like short list of people. Because Milk gave him a list like, these are the acceptable candidates.
People that I will allow you to replace
this him. This is what the gay community will allow. Uh-huh. We are fine with any of these people. Pick one.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
So this person was significantly left of Dan White. Obviously.
Imagine that.
Most people were. So on November 27th, the mayor was scheduled to announce the appointment of White's replacement at City Hall. That day, Dan White's, his aide, picked him up in the morning. She picks him up. He didn't come out of the front door as he normally would. He came out from the garage. Which was odd. This was the first time that she's just like, okay, that's weird, but like, whatever. So he had went down there to put on his old service revolver, a .38 special, which he always kept loaded with hollow point bullets.
No big deal. That's completely necessary to take to work with you.
On top of grabbing this deadly weapon full of bullets, he also took 10 more bullets.
Sure.
He wrapped them up in a handkerchief so they didn't rattle in his pocket.
Uh-huh, because you wouldn't want anyone to know.
People don't know, but Tux is also defense counsel. So he entered City Hall through a window in the basement. So he wouldn't have to go through the metal detector because there was increased security because of the People's Temple massacre that just happened.
So the aide...
Yeah.
That brought him to work.
She didn't see him go in through the window. She just dropped him off where he normally got dropped off.
Okay. She noticed that it was peculiar that he came out of the garage, but didn't notice that he went in through the basement window.
Well, I don't think she saw him.
Sure. Yeah. I know. But it's just like, huh.
Yeah. Huh is right.
Yeah.
Huh
okay.
is right.
Okay.
On the garage thing, but she didn't see this. But had she seen this, I like to think she'd been... Huh.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like, wait, why is he putting his body in through a basement window?
It certainly is peculiar.
It is very peculiar. So he ends up in the city soil lab is in the basement. That's where his whole body goes through this window. And there's like a lab tech who's just like, what the fuck, dude? What is happening? He's like, oh, I'm on the board of supervisors.
I'm climbing through this basement window.
He said
window.
He forgot his key. He had his office key. He didn't have a building key because there's no building key because they don't have
You don't need
keys.
A building key.
Oh, my God. However, the lab tech is just like, whatever, dude. Like, okay, you're climbing through a window. The tech doesn't really give a shit. He's just like, you know, not my job, whatever. You're in. It's fine.
I don't get paid enough for this shit.
You're presenting as an authority kind of vibe. I mean, again, he was a former cop, so I'm sure he gave off the, like, don't even ask questions. Like, you're already in trouble sort of vibe. So White, he confronts Mayor Moscone. They argue. Moscone, like, tries to offer him a drink. Like, hey, dude, like, you know, you're in your feelings. Like, calm down. Like, here's some whiskey. Like, let's just... talk this out. As Moscone is handing him a drink, White shoots him in the chest, which is very rude.
I'm like, at least take the whiskey first.
Thank you. Shoots him, drink drops. So once he's down, Dan White shoots him twice in the head. So after executing the mayor, he hurried across the hall to his old office. His name had already been removed from the door, but he still had his key.
Of course he had his key that he didn't need to enter the building, but he did need to enter his office.
So he went inside and reloaded his gun.
Uh-huh.
Then he walked out. He passed Dianne Feinstein, who is still the senator of California. So she sees him walking by her office, and she's just like, bitch, you resigned.
You don't work here anymore, motherfucker.
So she called to him, and like she's just like, hey, man, like what's going on? And he says, I have to do something first.
Oh, my God.
So he knocked on Harvey Milk's office door. He's invited in because Harvey doesn't know that he's about to be executed.
Sure.
Dan closed the door. He blocked the exit, and he shot Harvey 5 times. As with Moscone, the last 2 shots were to the head. A coroner later concluded that both men wouldn't have died if it weren't for the 2 shots to the head.
He's a cop. He knows. Point.
Yeah.
Yeah. He knows exactly what he needs to do.
He knows what he needs to do to not have witnesses.
Yeah.
And White, he just saunters out of the building.
Yeah.
Broad daylight.
He didn't even need the key to get out.
But people knew instantly what he did.
Sure, like, of course. Dying, yeah.
Like people heard gunshots.
Yeah.
So that same night, there is this impromptu vigil at City Hall.
Yeah.
It draws tens of thousands of people because they heard that Harvey Milk and the mayor had been shot by Dan White. Within a couple of days, Dan turns himself in to his former coworkers at his old precinct. He was not arrested, even though everyone knew that he did it. Every single person.
This man murdered 2 people.
A sitting mayor and his fellow supervisor.
In City Hall.
In City Hall.
And he got to wait a couple days and turn himself
in? He got to saunter out of the building. Dianne Feinstein, she found Harvey Milk's body. And there's like a press conference of her. And she's like kind of covered in his blood. And she's like, the chief suspect is Dan White. But days later, he turns himself in. He's not arrested.
Unbelievable.
When I was researching this story, I'm like, oh, I thought I knew. But I'm like, all the movies and even the documentary does not show you the trial. This is what happened. Like, he killed 2 people in cold blood. Everyone knew he did it. And they just kind of let it rock.
Okay.
He takes his sweet time. He goes to his old precinct. He finds his old partner and he confesses. He confessed that he wanted to kill 2 more of his colleagues. He wanted to kill Willie Brown, the first black man on the board of supervisors. Mm-hmm. And he also wanted to kill Carol Ruth Silver, who was the first like white Jewish woman who actually had been a freedom rider. He wanted to kill 4 people that day, and he only killed 2.
Jesus Christ.
And he said this aloud to his former colleague. So White, he's at the precinct. He's taken into custody because he turned himself in. Again, he was not arrested. He's charged with first-degree murder, and the city is full of all of these rumors that cops are letting him order takeout in jail.
Taking him to Burger King. And
yeah. Ugh. There isn't a lot of evidence for this. Again, it was like the late 70s, who knows? But there is proof that cops were actively fundraising for his legal defense.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a shock. It's not at all.
And some cops started wearing t-shirts underneath their uniform that said, Free Dan White.
Sure.
You know, bad apples, etc.
Yeah.
But we don't throw out the bad apples. Jesus we support Christ. Them. We give them money. So the trial starts, and diminished capacity is like the name of the game. For people who don't know, that diminished capacity basically means that like good people, like fine, upstanding people with good backgrounds simply don't kill people in cold blood.
Oh, yeah.
He snapped. You know, he snapped. He lost the capacity for rational thought, don't you know? It couldn't have been premeditated, even though all of the evidence to the contrary. therefore, he's not guilty, is what the defense was playing at. But also, that's every murder. Like, what murder isn't diminished capacity? Like, who's in their right mind when they kill someone in cold blood?
Literally.
Zero people. Why aren't the prisons empty? In my opinion, everyone who murders someone has a diminished capacity for conflict resolution at the very least.
You think?
Yeah. Very least. So it's like, is this a real argument? But okay, sure. So they go through his actual testimony when he confesses to the two murders that he done did. The question was, do you know how many shots you fired at Moscone? Answer, no, I don't. I don't. I, out of instinct, when I reloaded the gun, you know, it's just training I had, you know. And the next question was, where did you reload? He says, I reloaded in my office when I was, I couldn't out in the hall. So if White's reloading of his gun had been, as he said, like, instinctual, then he would have reloaded in Moscone's office. He wouldn't have gone down the hall, and it was a long corridor, to his office to put bullets in his gun and then go after Harvey Milk.
He knew enough to, like, he couldn't do it in the hall.
Yeah.
He couldn't do it in front of people.
Nope. Nope. So
he had to flee the scene of the first crime, and then he couldn't do it in front of people.
Garbage. So a psychiatrist testified, a psychiatrist for the defense, I might add, testified that White must have been mistaken in his recollection of, like, where he reloaded.
Because psychiatrists know when someone is...
Well,
mistaken about their location.
I think psychiatrists know when they're hired by the defense. Yes.
Psychiatrists know the value of a dollar.
There we go. So in his confession, White said that, I don't know why I put my gun on, meaning that morning. Like, why I'm wearing a fucking gun to my old employer.
Perhaps it had something to do with your desire to murder people.
Yeah, maybe it was like, maybe like vengeance was the reason why. So at the trial, psychiatrists offered reasons why he put this gun on. Psychological reasons.
Maybe he wanted mashed potatoes for lunch.
They said maybe it was like a security blanket.
That's very reasonable.
So that was one explanation. The other explanation was that it was like, you know, a practical reason. He felt under threat because of the People's Temple, like, hit squad. He felt like maybe there would be someone after him for some reason.
The cult is going to come and
Don't look at me like that. You know, reasonable.
Sure. Makes total sense.
He was just trying to protect himself. So in his confession to his, like, police buddy, he said that, this is a quote, I was leaving the house to talk, to see the mayor, and I went downstairs to make a phone call. And I had my gun there. Okay. But there was a phone upstairs, and he was in the house alone.
Mm-hmm. Did he speak to the gun?
His buddy, his, like, police buddy, never asked him, like, hey, who did you call in the basement when you were down there? Because that's why you were down there, to make a phone call. Because that would have been easily verifiable. Police buddy never asked. You know. Also in his confession, White said that after shooting Moscone, this is a quote, I was going to go down the stairs, and then I saw Harvey Milk's aide, because again, he's not talking to Harvey Milk himself.
Yes.
He's a petty ass bitch. I saw Harvey Milk's aide across the hall, and then it struck me about what Harvey had tried to do, meaning blocking his, like, rescinding of his resignation, I guess. And I said, well, I'll go talk to him. Which is great. However, his aide, who drove him there that day, testified that he had mentioned he wanted to talk to both Moscone and Milk in the car. All of this shit was premeditated, and yet we're going to get into
and
it.
And yet.
Yeah. So the defense brought two expert, like, psych witnesses to testify how his depression led to his diminished capacity. He had rage quit his job. He was having issues with his marriage and his wife. He was not making enough money because he had to quit his firefighting job. So they're arguing over finances. He was self-isolating. They also brought in people that he worked with to testify about his diet, which is kind of gross. There's like, oh yeah, he normally like ate really well and like worked out all the time, but like he hasn't been doing that. He has not been working out as much and he's been eating a lot of junk food.
Sure. I mean, that makes total sense to me. You know, totally. If you eat junk food, the people around you, their lives don't have value. It just makes sense.
If you don't think about it, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So on the witness stand, a psychiatrist, a man named Martin Blinder, testified that on the night before the murders, while White was getting depressed, this is a quote, he was getting depressed about the fact that he would not be reappointed. He just sat there in front of the TV, binging on Twinkies.
That poor man may as well have been the Three's Company defense.
Oh, no! Oh, don't put them in this! I mean, yeah, that's bad, but that's not Dan White bad? Come on. Come on. The San Francisco Chronicle reported that during the trial, no one except for this well-known satirist named Paul Krasner like played up this angle of like the Twinkies and like sugar.
Yeah.
So this comedian, he was the one who coined the Twinkie defense. And despite the fact that it was only mentioned once, similar to the fucking Murphy Brown shit, it was only mentioned once. This is most people's understanding of the case. Was a bad joke.
Yeah.
By a shitty, like, straight-ass comedian.
Yeah, yeah.
So skipping to the verdict, sadly, it's how the jury understood the whole trial as well. The jury was sold on this diminished capacity defense.
Not that
Twinkies were to blame.
Yeah.
They bought into the diminished capacity narrative that many things contributed to this break of his.
Sure.
One of which was his overconsumption of junk food, I guess. But isn't this every crime? Like, every crime is... Life challenges diminish your capacity to deal with your right to act right.
They weren't trying to convince the jurors that he didn't do it.
No.
They're just trying to convince the jurors that...
Mitigating circumstances, essentially.
He wasn't technically, legally guilty because... Blah, 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 blah.
Their whole thing was that he was not rationally acting. But a lot of it has to just do with his whiteness, also homophobia. But, I mean, he killed a straight white man as well. This story opens up so many other issues.
Yeah.
Just in American culture. This whole trial, I have at least, like, 3 mini episodes I want to do about this.
Yeah.
So... The jury, they were sold on this diminished capacity defense.
Yeah.
It wasn't that, like, Twinkies were to blame. They bought into this whole diminished capacity narrative that, like, you know, all these things in his life contributed to the fact that he made this one mistake.
Yeah.
And one of these things were his overconsumption of... junk food.
Sure.
Because this is the era where everyone is like eating bran and yogurt and carob.
Yeah.
Weird shit. He was acquitted of first degree murder, even though that's exactly what he did.
He literally first degree murdered
two people. He planned it in such immaculate fashion too. It was really hard for people to understand. Like a white man in power doing something bad.
Yeah, sure.
I love your laugh. Uh-huh. Thank you for that. So he was acquitted of first degree murder and convicted of voluntary manslaughter. He was sentenced to 7 years for the murder of 2 people, one of which was the mayor of the city that he resided in.
If he were committed, or if he were convicted of voluntary resignation.
How dare you! How dare you! So he was sentenced to 7 years. He would serve 5 of the years. And the jury, gay people were kicked off the jury. Selection process. Anyone who was not white was kicked off the jury. So the jury was entirely white, mostly women who had children around the same age as Dan White's children. So they saw him as like a father. Some of them cried when he testified out of sympathy for him. George Moscone also had children. Who cares?
No big deal. That doesn't mean anything.
Who fucking cares?
He's dead. Who cares about that motherfucker? Yeah.
So the jury is
it's in the super, past. Let it go.
Super, super widely rejected by everyone, not just the gay community. Everyone is just like, this guy got off light. Again, I fucking hate the criminal justice system, mm-hmm. but like everyone was like, this was not right.
Yeah.
This was a miscarriage of justice. Meanwhile, the cops are celebrating this victory.
I mean,
police radio channels played the song Danny Boy in honor of their former colleague who had just murdered 2 innocent people, one of which was their fucking mayor, but also bad apples, etc. So Dan White, he served 5 of the 7 years in state prison.
Uh-huh.
He went home soon after his marriage dissolved. 18 months after he was released from prison, he committed suicide.
Yeah. I don't have anything to say about that.
I know. The main thing with a Twinkie defense, air fucking quotes around Twinkie defense, because this is not the real fucking defense.
Yeah.
It was not about Twinkies. Duh. It was about homophobia. It was about an aggrieved white man who formerly had power, who could not deal with conflict resolution.
Yeah.
That was the real story to me. But what really rubbed me the hardest was how violent crimes become this like situational thing. When white people, white straight men are involved, then we fall over backwards to make explanations about why they did the thing, the violent thing that they did.
Yeah.
And it fucking sucks that this story was boiled down to this defense of like Twinkies, when it's really about the fact that the first openly gay man was assassinated in broad daylight and the person who killed him got off.
Yeah.
Very, very easily.
Ugh, what a mess.
I know.
The drinks are empty.
Yeah.
They've been empty.
Yeah.
I guess we're done. We're done. Are. That's it.
I'm over this.
America's history is juicy. We just add tequila for the first time.
Yeah. It was great.
Yes.
It cushioned all of our sadness.
Yes, exactly. Northern California sadness. Thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Tux Lurzel.
Stephanie Domingo.
Signing off.
Yes.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Beyond Reproach is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on land belonging to the Lenape Nation. Please note that we are not historians. We're just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. A full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. And remember that written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of 2 things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone who you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media, and make sure you follow us on Instagram, because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop at beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves, and we have exclusive content on Patreon where you can directly support the production of our show.